This podcast has been generously sponsored by John Spiro and family in honor of Aunt Vula.
When I started to write, I was always looking forward to the next lesson because my imagination didn't even allow me to plan out, to figure for myself how that pay was going to appear out of a pot of ink. And when I was shown how it happened, it was magic.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
Shalom and welcome to today's edition of This Pardes Life. I've said this before, but it's so much fun for me to do this, to be able to have people who are friends, who I respect very much, to interview them, to learn about them. And it's really, really great fun for me to have Dov Lehman in our studio today. Dov is a friend, a colleague, a teacher. He's one of those incredible people and who've taught me so much, not only from what he's taught me, but also in terms of not judging people by the way they look. If you were to look at Dov, you would think of him as just a typical chassid of whatever group he belongs to. But as I've learned from Dov, there's no such thing as a typical chassid. Every person is an individual. Every person is important and has thoughts and issues, not just to put people into boxes. When I ran the summer program, Dov would always bring me an article to read from the New Yorker or the New York Review of Books, something that would always set the tone for the summer for me. So it's a lot of fun for me to have this interesting, enigmatic, unusual person today. And Dov, I think we'll start off with the question that I think I want to know and many people want to know, which is, how did your life go to bring you to a place where you're a master calligrapher and a scribal artist? You do sofrot, you teach people how to be a scribal artist, you teach it in a way that is spiritual. How did your life lead, or what did you do that brought you to this place?
Hi, David. Thank you for that beautiful introduction. Very happy to be here with you. Regarding how I became a sofer, it was, as many steps in my life, almost by chance. The truth is, I never had thoughts that I wanted to be a sofer, or even that I wanted to learn to write. Everything was very vague until one day I walked into a store to have my mezuzot checked. And I noticed that in that store, they had a brochure on the counter which offered to teach people to write. And I picked up the brochure while I was waiting, and I thought, you know, that's interesting to me. I would like to learn how to write. I didn't have any thought that it would be a career, a profession. I thought that I'd like to learn how to write. So I negotiated with them, and I began studying. Rather in a different manner than how I teach the students here at Pardes. But I began studying, and the enthusiasm that I felt was very great. One thing led to another. After I mastered the basic skill, I started writing, and one step led to another.
How is the way you learned different from the way you teach at Pardes?
Well, first of all, the students here, I'm not teaching them to be sofrim. I want to give them a primary experience of, first of all, the physical experience and the skill. What is it to hold a kulmus, to write on parchment, to have the agony and the ecstasy of what it is to form letters? I just remember when I started to write, I was always looking forward to the next lesson because my imagination didn't even allow me to plan out, to figure for myself how that pay was going to appear out of a pot of ink. And when I was shown how it happened, it was magic. And I think to a certain degree the students have that here also. But, you know, when I learned, we learned a lot of halakhot, and we did a lot of review. Here, the class goes much quicker because the goal is different. And we essentially have a significant taste of what it means to write.
before we spoke, and even while you're speaking, I've been thinking, what is the word to describe what happens in your classes or what happens in a conversation to you with you? And you used the word Dov. You said magic. People who don't know Dov, you should just know he's a magician. He's a magician putting Harry Potter to shame. You said that you happened to walk into a Suffret store. You know, it almost sounds like a joke. A man walked into a Suffret store, and you said you walked into the Suffret store or to have your mezuzahs checked, the shop. What were you doing in your life at that point? How did your life get to a point? I know you grew up as a secular Jew in Canada. How did your life get to a point where you were at the beginning of that joke, a man walks into a mezuzah shop?
Essentially, at that point, I was newly married, my first marriage. So it made sense for us to have those mezuzahs checked. I didn't know anything about them. I was learning in yeshiva. I was learning in the Boston Kollel in Harnof at the time. My background, you know, what led up to that was Chazara b'tshuva around the age of 22. And after a short time in Israel where I was first introduced to yeshiva, what yeshiva is, I went back to Canada and I ended up in Los Angeles where Rabbi Landes was teaching at the Yeshiva University of Los Angeles. And that's where I formed a deep friendship with Danny and his wife. And after a short time, a year and a half in Los Angeles, then I came back to Jerusalem to do more study. I studied at a few different yeshivot.
If you look back at all your years of writing and of teaching writing, what are the benefits that you have accrued from doing this?
Oh, there are tremendous benefits, I think, in speaking modestly. First of all, the truth is, I think any skill, anything where a person uses his hands, which means uses hand-eye coordination, where you know a certain degree of intellect, which is focus everything, bringing everything together there, that's beneficial. That's beneficial for the soul. It's beneficial for the soul and for the mind. But beyond that, writing in particular, because it is very demanding. Right, there is such a thing as a kosher letter. A minimally kosher letter has to be made with intention. It's easy to make it not kosher, meaning you know incomplete. That degree of concentration, when you, eventually you get to the point where you're not simply learning, but actually writing text, creates a real meditative state. Time can go by quite quickly. Because the focus is out of time. Beyond that, for me in particular, with my orientation, meaning you know, my interest in Chassidut and Machshavot Yoter, I will call them Amukot, you know, deeper thoughts, I ended up spending a lot of my learning time. Learning texts have to do with thoughts regarding what letters are, what speech is, what divine speech is, which leads to fundamental questions about what the nature of Torah is, what the nature of the of prophecy is. So it's really helped me expand my whole worldview.
I was going to ask you whether it's a technique or an art. But it seems that the answer you've given is that it's a spiritual practice.
It's, of course, it's all those things. You know, thank God, because, you know, if I was learning woodwork, that would also be a technique, it would be a skill, and, you know, it would border on or become art. But here, because we're dealing with letters, and letters are, in our tradition, the foundation of all reality, so yes, of course it has gone beyond that.
In what way are letters the foundation of all reality?
Well, think back to your first psukim of Breshit. Basara ma'amarot, with ten acts of speech, HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates creation. Speech is made up of words. Words are made up of letters. Wherever you go in the vast literature that deals with letters, whether you go into the Kabbalah, you go into the Ari, or into the Sforim of the Zohar, or you open up any, at least, of the earlier generations of Chassidut, you can't read through a whole page without encountering a discussion of otiyot, of what letters are, what their place is in creation. Now, of course, it's a sophisticated thought, but at first it comes off as a naive thought. But the depth of otiyot is the depth of how does reality come into being? What is reality? We say there, or the Torah says there, Vayomer Elokim. The Torah, you would think, you know, I often think in terms of what I would say if I was writing the Torah. It would not be obvious to me if I'd be writing the Torah to say, and God spoke. One might have thought, and God made. But no, creation coming into being out of no thing is a creation that comes through speech. And then, when we look in the Mefarshim, you know, not necessarily esoteric Mefarshim, you look in the Ramban, he says, what does it mean God spoke? It means God had ratzon. God had will. Now, he doesn't define what will is, but when we move what speech is into an abstract quality, you know, there are worlds that are opened up. And, you know, this is a huge pursuit in learning.
It's almost like the postmodern fixation, I would almost say, with language, with words. You're saying that it happened a long time before modernity, postmodernity, with the Torah starting off and really saying, you know, it's through our acts of speech that worlds get created, and it's through acts of speech that God created the world.
That's right. And so for man to be created in God's image is primarily the image of speech, of expression of intellect, of expression of deep, of fundamental will, of what being human is, and of what being human in a Jewish sense, meaning human, which is primarily founded in spiritual reality, what that means, how a person chooses to direct his life and direct the directions of his life, meaning a person's intent in going about his life.
How does all of this affect the actual act of writing? And if I look at your work, how might it be similar or different from other people's?
All of this doesn't really have to affect the physical act of writing at all. There are certain halachic demands. For example, when a person begins a project, whether it's a Megillah or a Sefer Torah or a pair of tefillin or a mezuzah, a person has to make a verbal statement that he's writing l'shem kedushat the project. In other words, with a recognition and a purpose that this is going to be a housing, a presentation of the kedusha, the holiness of the particular mitzvah. This mitzvah object is not simply going to be; it has to be produced with an intent for fulfilling the mitzvah goal. And of course, and even more so, when a person writes a name of God, then also there's a special declaration, because a person has to focus on that and genuinely mean what they say, that they're writing L'shem Kedushat Hashem, for the sake of a divine name. So in that regard, intent is almost everything. However, after that point, after you've said once at the beginning of writing a Sefer Torah, whether it takes 4 months or 3 years, after that first statement, then a person simply goes ahead, goes on the momentum of having started with intent. And if a person gets up the next morning and simply goes about the task of writing without any deep thoughts or kavanot, the Sefer Torah is still kosher. But of course, you know, a person for himself knows that he's going to benefit the more he invests his soul in the practice.
Have you written a Sefer Torah? What is the biggest, longest or biggest work that you've done?
I haven't written a Sefer. I'll tell you why. Because I write pretty slow. I'm meticulous and slow. Great Sofrim are meticulous and fast. But I'm meticulous and slow, so I prefer projects which I know I'm going to finished in a reasonable amount of time. I write mezuzot. I write, most of my life I've written pairs of tefillin. I've written a number of megidot, you know, but more than a month, that's enough for me. I want to be sure I can get it done.
I'm very into the whole concept of finishing at the moment in my own teaching. Uh-huh. I'm speaking a lot about the importance of Pekudei, with Moses setting up the tabernacle, the importance of finishing. It's something that's very, very important to me at the moment. I'm interested what it's like for you, how you feel, and when you finish, even maybe just a klaf or a mezuzah or for a tefillin or a megillah, what does it feel like to have finished a piece of holy writing?
It generally feels wonderful. And the opposite side, at the beginning, as a new sofer, the trepidation to start a project is fantastic. Even the students I have now who are writing a practice column of a Megidah, before they wrote that first letter, they are nervous beyond imagination. But the truth is, as I mentioned, I'm writing mostly tefillin. Tefillin start with the letter vav, avaya daber. That vav, you always have to take a moment before you get started. But after a sofer is experienced, then even though you have to take that moment, after the vav is there, then all of the nervousness is gone, and you're just already totally in the recognizable rhythm of the project, and that's a beautiful shahr to pass through.
It's really beautiful what you're sharing, really, really beautiful. It's clear that Kabbalah and Hasidut really affect what you're saying and how you live your life. Could you share with us how you got involved in the Hasidic community and tell us a little bit about the community you belong to?
It's a little complicated, but I'll see what I
we
can
like
do.
We like complicated.
essentially, I met my Rebbe, who was Rav Sholem Friedman, the Admor of Horna Steipel. Horna Steipel is one of the Chatzerot of Chernobyl in its origin. He lives here in Jerusalem. He's originally from Denver. And I met Rav Friedman simply through someone who was already learning there, who said to me, you might find this interesting. So I walked in one night, and essentially I've been learning with him for over 30 years now. In the neighborhood here, in the Pardes, in this part of town, I've also been davening for many, many years with the Kehila, which is called Erloi. Erloi is a very a unique kind of Chassidut, because the Erloi Rebbe, who just recently passed away, was the fifth generation from the Chatam Sofer, the great Hungarian scholar. And that place also, I walked in the first time. I walked in the first time because I used to daven not at Erlo, I used to daven a different place in Katmon, the old Breslov Shul. And that was a really wonderful place to daven. And I used to go there. And when I was walking home with my wife Friday night, we many, many times used to pass by the most beautiful, shining face of a man, a Rav in his 60s, white already, with many Bokrim, teenaged Hasidic young men around him. And this man was so much makrin, he so much radiated light, and not just radiated light, but he radiated intentionally to the street around him. In other words, all I mean to say is, whoever passed by him on the street as he was walking home from shul, he stopped. He said good Shabbos to that person with a smile unlike any other smile of any face in the world. And it made a huge impression on me. And after it's happened a few times, I thought to myself, you should find out where he davens. And the first time I walked into his base medrash on an Erev Shabbos, immediately someone took care of me with a smile, found me a place to sit, and essentially, Erloi also, I've been davening there for over 30 years, and it's a huge loss to personally and obviously for the greater community that this rabbi, who was the manhig of his community for 70 years, has left the world.
It sounds like you've had the schut, the pleasure, the privilege to be welcomed into many different powerful communities and to become part of them. And we also value you being part of our community. You spoke about how you felt the first time working into Erloy. You spoke about the first time walking into that tefillin shop and in other places.
Yes.
How did you feel the first time walking into Pardes?
There was a different kind of trepidation. The truth is, I started teaching at Pardes because Rabbi Landis invited me. And the truth is, when he invited me, my nature was to say, you know, thank you, but no. Not because of Pardes, but because, you know, it was my nature, a shy nature. But I had some seichel, and I said to myself, you would be a fool to turn down the opportunity. So I forced myself to say yes, and I started the class. And the truth is, you know, sometimes people think, oh, Dov, like, you know, why would you want to go teach in a place so different than your orientation? But of course, it was exactly the opposite. You know, I was afraid to walk in because I thought, who would want to study with me? Who would want to learn with me? But thank God, I learned quite early in my teaching here that there was always the capacity to create a real rapport of honesty, of a genuine respect, echad l'sheni, one for the other. And that really, I suppose, I attribute to my background. I made tshuva when I was 22. I never abandoned the world that I came from, maintained close connection with my family, with my old friends, with the loves that I had, my love for music, my love for, as you mentioned at the beginning, the New York Review of Books. That's another thing that I've had for more than 30 years. That subscription I've had for, 40 years already. I wouldn't want to live without those things. So that particular eclectic mix, provided me with success here.
It's almost like a complete circle from what we started off with. I started off by saying, like, when I looked at you and when I met you the first time, I came with certain assumptions about how people look and how they dress. And these assumptions were broken down. And it seems you've had the pleasure also with Pardes students of really, like the same way I got to know you as an individual, really getting to know all of them as the individuals they are. Every student at Pardes is an individual. But of course, one of the most striking things, perhaps from a classic viewpoint, is that men and women study together at Pardes, including in your class. The Gemara of Gittin 45b says, Sifrei Torah, Tfilin, and Mezuzot written by a heretic, a star worshipper, a slave, a woman, a minor, a kuti, or an apostate Jew are unfit for ritual use. How do you make a bridge between this Gemara and the women who are in your class?
Well, my approach to teaching is that I'm teaching adults. And essentially, you know, that's not to be taken for granted. But I assume that I'm teaching adults, which means that adults have the capacity and the responsibility to make decisions, and they have to live up to the consequences of those decisions. You know, so essentially, in the question of women writing, as you mentioned, that breita, the breita of Rebbe Hamnuna in Gittin, the statement is about Sifrei Torah, Tfilin and Mezuzot, that women, amongst a long list of other people who are not obligated in wearing Tfilin, are not eligible to write those kosher texts. Essentially, I present the halacha. I mean, what I will call really in class, the Orthodox halakha, because you know we have rabbinical students from HUC or from JTS or from Hebrew College or other places. I'm quite happy to say this is the halakha as I've received it. This is the halakha as it's written, for example, in the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah. Where you, as the student, go with it, whether you embrace it or reject it, essentially, I'm putting that on your shoulders. I don't feel that I have to be paternalistic enough to decide for you if you can learn or not, if I have to tell you in absolute terms what the halakha is and make a demand from my students that they keep my halakha. That's the first thing. Second thing, of course, is that, and this we learn every time we have a session, we learn that braita, and we learn what we know from Rabbi Hamnuna as what's called ukshartem uchtavtam, from the last two psukim of the Shema, where at first it sets out the mitzvah of tefillin, and then it describes the writing of a mezuzah. And Rabbi Hamnuna says there, if you are one of those people who are obligated in ukshartem of tying on tefillin, then you are also one of those people who are eligible to do the uchtavtam, the writing of not simply mezuzah, but all of those projects which from the Torah need a written mitzvah object. Then we go, and essentially I don't question that braita. I do point out that if we were in the Beis Medrash with Rabbi Hamnuna, we would question that braita. Why is it that tefillin and mezuzot and Sefer Torah are all lumped together, especially when women have exactly the same obligation as men in the mitzvah of mezuzah? According to Rabbi Hamnuna, the woman has to put a mezuzah up on the door of her apartment, but she can't write her mezuzah. But essentially, where we go to is regarding Purim and Megillat Esther, where there's a huge difference of opinion in the poskim about whether women are eligible to write a kosher Megillah. I point out, and I'm focused on the Orach HaShulchan, one of the great more modern poskim. Not, 100 years ago, yeah, that modern.
Very modern for us.
Who essentially argues that Megillah isn't bound up with the momentum of Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Sefer Torah, and women, because they are obligated in Megillah, they may write a kosher Megillah. So that's the foundation that's essentially where I encourage my students who want to continue with writing at least to start there. I'll admit, I've had a lot of students, mostly women, who have gone ahead and written Sifrei Torah. They understand that, from my perspective, the Sefer Torah is not kosher, but, because the truth is, we do sometimes find ourselves with values that are at odds with our tradition. I can't reject one or the other, but I can make something technical as opposed to having my whole world hinge on it. So I say, listen, I can't say a bracha on your Sefer Torah, but I'm not going to tell you not to write. I have even found what I think is a legitimate way to justify women writing. I see women writing Sefer Torah essentially as a, not as a kosher Sefer Torah, but as, as a document which is either used in a meditative manner, or simply it's a Sefer that has a, from my perspective, a technical problem that it can't be used. I think perhaps never had a student, a woman who really was establishing herself as a soferet, who felt offended by that. Essentially, the integrity that comes with respect opens all doors.
Thank you very much for that. Alavai, that there should be more people who think like this in Am Yisrael. In terms of a community, how is this seen? Teaching women.
In terms of my communities, like the communities that I daven and learn with, well, I'm a person who is, in a sense, a welcome or permanent guest in a number of different communities, but not truthfully found in the middle, in the embrace of any of them. My rabbi, I have never told that I teach at Pardes or that I teach men or women, you know, men who are not Orthodox or women who are or are not Orthodox to write, the place where I daven, I would never tell them, because it's totally out of their world. They would hate it. I would think that their natural response to be, the sky is falling. You are causing the sky to fall. I happen to not think that, so it's only in my best interest, and I think the best interest of everyone, including those people who I'm not informing, for there to be a certain lack of total, how do we say it?
Dissonance, maybe.
Well, a presence of dissonance, a lack of total presentation of self. I've learned to live with that.
It seems a lot of the theme of what we're speaking about is the ability to weave different worlds and different lives together in such a way that really doesn't make any of them parava, doesn't water down any of them, but lets them live together, sometimes amicably, sometimes a little harder. But it seems to me that you really are not only a letter writer, but a weaver of different strands of the Jewish world that seem to come together.
My wife calls it being a bridge person. And, you know, even if you are occasionally successful as being a bridge person, that is a big honor to be able to fulfill a position like that in the world.
One of the things that I know that students love in your class is that it's not just about technique, and it's not even just about halachot or just about art, but also all the beautiful insights that you share with your class about the letters and about how they come together. You've already given us a little bit of an opening into your world when you speak about the letters and how the world was created about on letters and words and how important that is. As we conclude our interview now, I'd love you just to share one of your favorite thoughts with us, or maybe just the thought that you're thinking at the moment that you'd like to share with our listeners.
I'll share with you briefly the first lesson we have, like our introductory class, after we learn to write a straight line and then two parallel straight lines and then to connect them with a vertical back. In other words, after we learn to make a bait, then we learn a short piece of halakha from the Mishnah Berurah to show how challenging it is to describe a graphic reality only in words. And in that text of the Mishnah Berurah, he does something which is exceptional for him, which is he includes a medrash, which essentially is not in any way an instruction about the presentation of the physical presentation of the letter. And the medrash is like this. It's a medrash in the Yerushalmi, in Masechet Chagiga, and it asks about what we've just learned, which is that on the top of the bait, just, you know, picture for yourself a bait, which is a straight horizontal line, and below it another straight horizontal line, and on the right side, those two horizontal lines at their right-hand extreme are connected by a back, you know, a vertical line. But on the top of the top horizontal line, there are two tiny lines that are called tagim. On the left-hand extreme is a line that points straight up, and the tradition is that on the right-hand extreme, on the right-hand corner, there's a line that doesn't point straight up, but it points back like a diagonal, as the Agadata there in Chagiga says, towards the Aleph. So here's the Talmud Yerushalmi, let's say, 1,500 years ago, and it says the following. Why does the Beit have these two insignificant lines on top of it? Meaning to say, these lines are not essential to the kashrut of the letter. If you would write all the Beits in a lifetime of writing without any lines on top, you would still have written kosher Beits. So why do we have such a thing? So the Medrash does that Agadata does something beautiful. It says, the two lines on top of the Beit, the Agadata chooses to ask the following, teaches a lesson like this. The Agadata asks the Beit, Mi Barach, who created you? Meaning, where do you come from? Where is your existence? Is your existence derivative? And the Bait answers, not in words, but the Bait answers with a graphic reality on that left-hand extreme by pointing straight up. And my understanding of pointing straight up is, I have a creator, and my creator is infinitely beyond me. This is a power relationship. There is no horizontal dimension. The Bait points straight up. And then the Agadita chooses to ask the Bait again, Umashmo, now that we know that you have a creator who is infinitely beyond you, what is his name? What does it mean to have a name? To have a name means that there is some aspect of relationship between two. And there, the Bait answers by pointing, not straight up, which would essentially mean he has no name, I have no relationship, and it doesn't point simply horizontally, meaning he and I are peers. The Bait points at an angle, back towards the Aleph, but also pointing up, as the Agadita points out, meaning to say, Echad Shmo, his name is one. Now, for me, we could learn this Medrash and the depth of the Medrash all year long. This is what Spinoza is addressing. This is what Kabbalah is addressing. In all of its depth and all of the detail, we are addressing the relationship between an infinite source that is unknowable, what we generally call Ein Sof, and all of creation, which is called Echad Shmo. Just point out one more detail about that Medrash. When the Bait points towards the Aleph and says, Echad Shmo, God's name is one, there's a beautiful remez there, because the Aleph itself, the letter Aleph, is made out of a Yud, the top part of the Aleph, and another Yud, which is the bottom part of the Aleph, and the body of the Aleph is a Vav. If you take the gematria of those three letters, Yud and Yud and Vav, you have 10 and 10 and 6. And 10 and 10 and 6 is 26, which is the gematria of Yud-Ke Vov-Ke. So the Bait is really giving a remez to say, you want to know the name of a Kodesh Baruch Hu? Kodesh Baruch Hu's name in this world is Yud-Ke Vov-Ke. Haya Hove Vihia. That is the essential tsura of reality. That is the levush of how we perceive and recognize the Kodesh Baruch Hu in the world.
Thank you, Dov.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.